Right. This is actually a theory talk, more or less, but not completely. And what I thought I would do, since this is, although we do have two theory talks associated with the Bee Fest that begins tomorrow and the next day, I thought I would take a look over some of the things that have been treated in the program. I wasn't here for the whole time, but I was here for significant portions of it, and in particular touch upon some of the issues that have been much discussed here associated with non-Gaussianity, but in particular whether or not we should be pursuing theories associated with the anomalies on large scales. I guess I can just use a finger. Sure. Well, it doesn't matter. I'll just continue. Ah, good. A more modern device. Okay, so what we would like to see is sense being made of the anomalies. One of the ways sense could be made is if one just dismisses them as a curious statistical artifact, but they have persisted through a long sequence of experiments from COBE onward, and so there is still to be done a grand unified theory of anomalies in which they're all explained under one generalized phenomenology. So that would be nice. One of the things that we'll be able to do with Planck, and should be done for the next release, approximately June 2014, is to study the anomalies in polarization. And if the anomalies are associated with primordial curvature fluctuations, then they too should have polarization in the same way that that ordinary curvature fluctuations have polarization associated with them. If they're associated with some other phenomenon, then perhaps the polarization properties would be quite different, in which case that would be telling us something. Also, it may be a way of really trying to understand statistical significance, because they would have to be also significant in polarization. The anomalies are non-Gaussian and non-statistical isotropy. The question is whether it is just an example of broken Gaussianity, that is to say, because we have only one realization and most of these are on relatively large scales, maybe because we are doing finite sampling of the modes, you can get some kind of essentially like a symmetry breaking in which that can be the explanation. I doubt that, but you never know. Let's talk about two examples of the persistent anomalies. One is, of course, the famous WMAP cold spot anomaly. We've also done some work on this, as we was also done in the Planck paper. This is with some people that you will hear about in a moment. And on a coherent scale of 826 minutes of arc, we estimate that the probability of such a finding such a cold spot is 1 in almost 500. And then as you vary this, it drops and changes. But there is a coherence in scale. And so the relevant issue here is we're taking delta T over T, and we're adding an extra dimension, which is scale space, which is basically a smoothing scale. It drops to at a scale of 360 minutes for smoothing, it drops to a significance of 1 in 9. So there's this coherence associated with it that persists through some of scale space, and there's effectively a structure in that space. The power spectrum asymmetry, I think it's fairly robust that it's 7% at low L. But it's unclear at the moment if there is any at high L, and in fact that was one of the big discussion points of the meeting we had here in April. The Doppler-dipole modulation does exist, been detected at high significance, and it actually steals some of the power spectrum anomaly. I sort of like this one better, but let me go to that. And so that actually is what is obscuring somewhat whether there is a residual power spectrum anisotropy at high L. So it is true that with the Planck data, the high L non-Gaussian pattern constraints, where the basic patterns were tried, are quite restrictive. However, if you make the nonlinear portion of the of zeta, which is a measure, for example, it's ln A, curvature fluctuation, if that nonlinearity is decoupled, non-correlated, with the dominant source of the Gaussianity, which arises in models, in particular the models that we explore, then you can really open up the constraints. They aren't nearly as restrictive. So another aspect of this, which we raised in the cosmology meeting in April, is that if you have splotches of power associated with another source, then the measures of FNL, for example, depend upon the support of that nonlinear content to the third power, or nonlinear Gaussian. In other words, if you concentrate it, then it would automatically knock down F effective, because that's an all-sky measure, FNL effective. However, that wouldn't be the way to go after an effect like that where things are concentrated. You want to do another kind of search. That kind of search would be essentially looking for sources on the sky, which is, of course, something that we have a lot of experience in, except that these are extended sources. And there is a characteristic scale associated with those, and who knows what that is, and the theory is certainly not good enough to be able to fully nail it, although there are some points about this that I'll raise as we proceed. One way to get this decoupled nonlinear component is to try and get it out of isocurvature, or isocon degrees of freedom, those that are orthogonal to the inflaton direction and field space. And so they should be abundant in inflation. Every time you have a field structure, in addition to the inflaton, it should have zero-point fluctuations. Those zero-point fluctuations should exist on all scales. An example is, of course, the graviton tensor component, but any other scalar field will have it. So ideas that we have for trying to generate such things, one thing that we made a big deal of is modulated heating. This is a fairly long history, but not in the specific form that we're taking it. And the idea there is that you get modifications of zeta that depend upon some kind of field variables which have a structure on all scales. Isocurvature, degree of freedom. The one that I favor at the moment is sort of an axionic, so it's an angle field that would exist. It would be in effect perpendicular, if you like, to the inflaton direction. But you can also have it, and this was the thing that was explored by Matthias and Lev Kaufman and others earlier on, and we've also explored it here, is that the coupling constants could depend upon very large scales, because the coupling constants may be informed by fields that would exist, and so then they would imprint themselves upon the potential, and that would imprint itself upon curvature fluctuations. What is interesting about this is that when you're dealing with the inflaton, you essentially have no choice. The inflaton has to end inflation, so that there is essentially, it's not really a boundary condition, but it has to pass through the passage from acceleration to deceleration. No choice. So that basically is defining that you have a fundamental passage that, at least within our Hubble patch, the inflaton must have passed through. There is no such criterion for the isocurvature degrees of freedom, and they can have the random variable aspect on ultra-large scales, and in particular, they can have the random variable aspect on scales which are larger than the horizon. And in fact, in any sort of stochastic inflation picture, you expect that, and those values of that field might be very large because you tend to have a nearly scale invariant wander of that field, which can have, I mean, it's very similar, of course, to the gravitational potential fluctuations, which are a little redder than flicker noise and have these really long wavelength aspects to them, and those long wavelength aspects exist on scales larger than the horizon. Of course, what we usually do is you go in immediately and you do a horizon scale filtering, because we are usually only interested in delta-phi gravitational potential differences on the scale of the horizon at most. Whereas here, if you have this random variable that's there, that random variable can be a control parameter that can change consequences if you have a phenomenon that occurs that depends upon the specific value of that. And that's what happens here with these sort of modulated heating terms. Another example of non-Gaussianity, you might say non-Gaussianity in the extreme, is the vision that the universe is a bubbly creature in which quantum tunneling prevails from one vacuum to another in a way that I'll be talking about, and so that there are bubbles inflating all over the place, and there is a possibility, and those that play the game would say it's an inevitability, that all bubbles will end up colliding in an eternal universe, which other people say. I don't have to go as far as eternal universe or any of that. We're looking here at interesting phenomena that occur with the bubbles. Now, you can try, as I'm doing here, to relate this to the phenomenology that we see with the CMB. But irrespective of that, it really is a fascinating story, these stories in nonlinear field dynamics, multi-field dynamics. And really, the only way you can go after it is by lattice simulations. You can do a little bit of theorizing, but if you really want to make progress and if you want to really understand the detail, you have to do large-scale lattice simulations. And I'm fortunate to have collaborators, including a graduate student, Jonathan Braden, who was here in the April session, who's very good, but also Froloff and Shiji Wong, that we have codes that are really very, very efficient. There is a symplectic code that has been added to Froloff's defrost code, which is publicly available, but not with all the bells and whistles we have now. It's very, very fast. And then while here, Jonathan, there was a talk, and I'll talk about the talks in a moment. There was a talk about oscillons, and I'm going to mention something about that as we proceed. And it was, the way these were calculated with Richard Easter's P-Spectre code, which is a spectral code for trying to run simulations. So this defrost code is a lattice code where you are coupling lattice sites in real space. In a spectral code, you work in a Fourier transform space. And that can be quite efficient and can be quite good, especially for certain aspects of following the post-processing of inflation dynamics. And so Jonathan just sort of sat down and wrote a new code, which is much, much faster than what had been done before. Okay, if you have something like an intermittent non-Gaussianity, which certainly the collisions of bubbles are, and as is this, as we should see, there is, unfortunately, but it's what we're having to live with the idea of a landscape, a statistical landscape of possibilities. That is to say, you would be drawing what would happen from random variables, like this random variable of what the value of these fields are on scales larger than the horizon. So that's not a very comfortable position to be in, because you would just be able maybe to constrain that random variable, but it's not like having an attractor which is telling you this is exactly the way things are going to look. Of course, we have essentially gone away from that whole picture in inflation in recent years anyway, because the landscape is there and it's not going back into the box. Okay, so these things will be there at some level. The question is, will they be at a level that we will be able to actually detect some evidence for? So there's a list of papers, collaborators. Almost all of the papers that I have are never seem to make it out the door, but hopefully soon. So I thought I would take the opportunity here to remind you of some of the things that we've done in the course of this meeting. So these I'll just focus on those associated with non-Gaussianity and anomalies. So that includes the anomalies. There was some stuff on the power asymmetry that I mentioned. Jonathan gave a talk. I gave a talk about potentials of relevance to this late time behavior associated with preheating. Mustafa Amin talked about nonlinear field dynamics after inflation, but in particular talked about the concept of oscillons arising. Oscillons we see in our bubble collisions, and so that's why this is related to this. Then we had the meeting, and of course, not surprisingly, non-Gaussianity was one of the major topics of conversation because it connects so strongly to the fundamental cosmology, and as well as the isotropy and statistics discussion, because that's intimately related in terms of the power asymmetry. And so there was a talk there, and one by Anthony Lewis and Duncan Hansen, who talked about the modulation. And so there was a little bit of strong interaction of the first kind between Planckian authors. And it was actually quite healthy. And the summary right now, and I'll get to this in a moment, is that because of this, it's obscuring some of this. And so I'll explain that in a moment. Then there were some theory talks. Kleben was talking about bubbly things and some of his own favorite models. And then there was some talks that were associated with non-Gaussianity in the more standard higher L sense. And then there were some panel discussions. There were lots of panel discussions, but Froloff talked a little bit about some of the implications of what we're dealing with. May was mostly devoted, it seemed, according to Eva, to non-Gaussianity and other things from large-scale structure observations, and whether or not that's doable, and do we understand enough to make it doable. And there were a number of talks about that. I'm not quite sure what Matthias talked about, but I have a good idea. And then this is what I'm talking about here. Okay, so when George gave a talk, we turned it a little bit to a discussion of the anomalies. Okay, and so this is the cold spot anomaly. These things in the plane, we tended to mask them out and not really pay much attention to them. And then the issue was whether the multi-frequencies, the larger frequencies associated with Planck, meant that we should take them very seriously in terms of how rare these ups and downs are. And I'd say that's still unclear. It is pretty neat that when WMAP went and added Planck's 353 gigahertz dust map to try and do further cleaning of the WMAP maps, you get this arbitrarily nice relationship between the two experiments, and they all have the same anomaly structure. That's the main point here. However, the question is whether any of this is holdover. George is trying to claim, without very much good reason, I suppose, that maybe it's associated with the anomalous microwave emission. We have a Planck paper very soon to come out on that, among the other things that we've done. That is an interesting frequency range that would not be nailed in any sort of synchrotron-type template. So I am not at all convinced that that's the case, but it's an interesting thing. It requires a lot further exploration. Polarization will be one way. Certainly for synchrotron, these are highly polarized. And the anomalous emission is less polarized, I think, because it's really tiny spinning grains. Okay, and so before they did the 353 cleaning, that was WMAP, and so you see the same basic structure. So it doesn't seem that dust is playing that much of a role, and it was seen in COBE, which doesn't deal with dust at all. Okay, so this is just circling around, this being the rare cold spot, and this is when it's made on one of these sort of sphere rotations so that it's not as distorted, because the cold spot is always at the extreme end here. And so this is the cold spot here. It looks a little bit rounder than it does there. And in fact, if you analyze it, it looks somewhat round. It's got a really interesting interior structure. Unclear if that structure is fully compatible with Gaussian field, but I won't get into that. I mentioned already something about the chance of such a rare event.
This chance doesn't depend on exactly what you're talking about, because you're fixing the size.
No, you're letting the size scan.
But it's not 1 in 500. If I
just no, that's what I said. I said as you change the scale of the filter, it moves.
Yeah, but if you have a random, you start doing Gaussian simulation normally.
Are you saying, do you see this?
Yeah.
You don't. You don't. This is a...
No, this is not if you pick the specific size. How many
you don't get. You don't get 5 sigmas.
It's not 5 sigma. This is 5 sigma after you've picked the... This is the 5 sigma.
No, that's true. That's the extreme.
Exactly.
Here with the WMAP, as you change the scale, this is not...
I mean, if you go look at the paper by WMAP, they say the anomalous paper.
Well, I know they do, and I don't agree with that.
So this is clearly that there's some debate on this, but it's all has to do with this a posteriori nature of the story.
Where's Joe? I tried to ask him this last week. He was quite...
He's always scathing towards this.
He accused me of being a frequentist, as if it was an error slot.
You know...
He accused me of being a base thing.
So my attitude here is something is staring you on the sky, staring at you on the sky. It's been there for a long time. And you're saying, oh, no, you don't exist. Oh, no, you don't exist. And that's a kind of silly attitude in my view.
My car has been staring at me at I don't know, 5 years. If I compute the probability that I get ZW, whatever, it's going to be very slow, small. It's a posteriori thing, right? So you have to be very careful with these a posteriori things.
I don't think that your license plate plays a role in this.
It's the same kind of question.
This is a Gaussian random field in which all statistics are completely understandable. And in particular, when you add the scale, it's still a Gaussian random field.
That doesn't matter. If you just look at something strange, and then you invent a statistic...
No. But you see, that's not really that's not really what it's done.
So the cold spot is...
I mean,
like,
all right, let me give...
Let me
give an example, right? How is it that we go after clusters in CMB?
Exist for a long time. I mean, it's not the question about clusters. Okay?
I know, but the way you go after it is you assume that there is a spectrum, as we're assuming there's a spectrum, and you let the characteristic scale of a spherical, because we know they aren't spherical entity go over the map, and you adjust that until you get the best fit. And you're saying that, illegal. But you're saying it's not illegal because I happen to know that clusters existed before. But if I'm looking for unknown sources, how would you trip over an unknown source? How would you find a source if you don't search for sources.
Okay.
And how do you search for sources? You do exactly this. You go over, and in this case, they're extended sources.
If it's the case that you see only one...
No, but you see it with a coherent structure. So the issue is, you go into it, and you try...
In the case of a, I mean, it's obvious, okay? I think it's clearly...
No, I'm not saying that this is the absolute number. This is the number that is, when you plot it, or when you look at the trajectory in scale space, it's where it's got its minimum or maximum, depending upon how you want to word it. So what happens is moving down, it's got a coherent set of scales, and then it comes back up again as you go to large scales. Well, what's wrong with that? That's an entity in scale space.
There's no chance that you get such a phenomenon at random. It's not a 5 sigma thing, because you are varying and you're getting the worst possible situation of some statistic that you are also already picked up after the cold spot has been discovered, okay? It's like the SH of the Stephen Hawking.
No, it's not like the SH of the Stephen Hawking.
It's a little bit like that. If I pick somebody out in this group and say, you are going to win the lottery next Sunday, I'm most probably wrong. But if I'm allowed to vary over all people who play until I get the guy who has won it.
You say it to everyone.
You're just, I think what you're saying is crazy. This is a well-defined statistical problem that involves you're checking it relative to a Gaussian random field with an extra dimension, which is the scale, and it's still Gaussian with that extra dimension. Therefore, you can absolutely decide whether it works or doesn't work in terms of...
Shouldn't you investigate the question, what is the probability that I get a cold spot of an arbitrary side and an arbitrary effect?
No. You have to take into account that it's a coherent structure. And I mean, what you're trying to say is that what I have are these slices in scale, and that each slice is independent of the next slice, and that isn't true. I mean, the whole point is that it's a continuous Gaussian random field with scale being a variable. Therefore, the correct statistical question is not, you know, that I have these arbitrarily densely packed slices, and therefore I can roll the dice independently for each one. What I have is a coherent structure that exists throughout quite a large set of scales.
How surprised should we be that there's such an... I doubt very much that it's a 5 sigma.
So when you say 5 sigma, look elsewhere.
What I would like you to define for me, because everybody loves to say look elsewhere, what is the definition of look elsewhere mathematically? That's what I want.
Run the same thing that you do in the data.
No, you're just saying let's do a lot of realizations. You do not get this, and unfortunately I didn't have it with me. You do not get it with random realizations. You don't get it. You have this coherent structure, and you do not see this with a large number of random realizations, which is what we have done in trying to check.
Random realizations will have a cold spot in it, and it's just a question of how deep it is.
And you should see also cold spots and hot spots.
Well, no, that is true. That is true. But what you see is that you have this cold spot spectrum, and then you have this outlier. And it's a real outlier, and that outlier remains there as I change the scale. And it's sort of way out there. And there are other anomalies, but they, you know, we always used to dismiss them because they were too close to the plane. So we said, forget it, because we're doing aggressive masking. But now the issue is whether or not we should be considering, because of the nature of the component separation, that we can actually consider what's happening in regions closer to the plane. Because it is a weird thing, and I will not deny it's a weird thing, and if I were to choose a smoking gun here, it would be, man, how can you try and tell me that weirdos are those things that are passing through the plane? But this isn't, but those are.
I mean, isn't the way to think about this to compare models that make predictions for this? I mean, if you have a model that can predict this, it'll be much better.
Well,
concept and field,
right? Yeah, but my point here is that in spite of the fact that we do have models, the trouble with the models is that there are too many degrees of freedom associated with them, so they aren't the best way to actually characterization.
I mean, if you have a sleep now.
Yeah, no, you want a complete upfront Bayesian analysis of this relative to a perfectly well-defined theory. Nobody's done that, nobody will do that, because that involves understanding completely what the interior structure is. We have a good idea with the intermittency I'm talking about, but nonetheless, because of the control variables, it can fluctuate all over. So I don't have a unique characteristic scale of what that theta C would be. It just says that it comes in splotches, and sometimes the splotches are bigger, and that, if I can get to it, will hopefully become somewhat clearer. But then the question is, can I go in with just a few parameters? And that's, of course, what people do. What do? They do a characteristic smoothing scale, which is like a coherence scale, and then they go in and look for it, right? But they usually let that coherence scale vary. Oh, does that sound like a sphericalized filter? Yes, because that's what you do. That's what you do when you do searching for sources, whether extended or point sources. It's what you do, and what you try and do is you do, you know, optimal filtering, et cetera, et cetera. It's what I did way back when there was this claim of non-Gaussianity, Gorski and Magueggio and those people, in the COBE data. Crittenden and I, we did exactly this process on the COBE data, trying to look for anomalous sources. We didn't find them in the COBE data, but it was a logical thing to do. If you're saying that non-Gaussianity exists, it's a logical thing to go after it with a variable scale bank of filters.
Often when you do source finding, you can accept a pretty high fault tolerance, right? Because you have some other way of following it.
Yeah, exactly. So the phi sigma is...
But the whole point is that we are following it up. We're going to follow it up in particular with what is its polarization structure like.
So I think the phi sigma is just the outcome of the calculation, right? So
No. Here is what the disagreement is, and I am totally in agreement with the disagreement, which is that phi sigma is for one characteristic smoothing scale, but it becomes just a little bit less than that as I change the smoothing scale in one direction and another direction. And so that the full analysis of how you actually decide what the probabilities are is associated with a continuous analysis in that space where I have this extra dimension, which is the scale, right? So that's how you do it, and that's not what I've actually done, except I set up the problem, and nobody else has done either.
But you said that you run simulations, no?
So no, simulations, yeah, we don't see this at all.
But then you can quantify, you take the maximum...
Right.
The same thing?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, with 500 simulations, you do not see this. You just don't.
It also depends on what is the definition of this.
Of this?
Yeah, because your curve, you start putting many details on this curve, you'll see what are you doing?
Let me put it that way.
It's a Gaussian.
Okay, so can I show you what happens when you sweep filters? This is what we think is an optimal analysis for this sort of thing. So this is the cold spot, and I'll try and play it again, right? And so look how the coherence develops. It means that it isn't just this suddenly appearing thing. It's there over a wide range of scales.
We see it with the eye. If we start moving, it will still survive. I mean,
Okay, so let me show you what it looks like in the interior. So this is the cold spot smoothed on 13 degrees, nice spherical thing. This is zooming down to 4 degrees. There's a really weird thing that it looks like in the short distance interior. Geez, I really didn't want to... Whoops. See what it looks like when you go really far down into it? Geez, I really didn't expect that I would get stuck on the cold spot here. This is supposed to be a theoretical talk.
But all these 5 sigma, you know, this is not... It's misleading.
It is, in fact, for the number of... unfortunately, I don't have... We have this great set of plots where these things are compared in detail with the number of peaks of a Gaussian random field. This is the formula that George and I did in 87. Works perfectly. And then there's this thing way out there. Right, everything is really good. And then there's that.
No, I think probably everybody agrees that this cold spot is unlined in some definition. Now, the number, because, okay, some unlined, you think you also agree there would be here, because there's a lot of bond.
Yep, okay. I'm going to. Anyway, I get the sentiment of the group.
We recently, Kendall Smith and Stephen Osborne, we did the optimal analysis for bubble collisions. Well, indeed, this kind of analysis that people were talking about is we simulated, we looked in every map for this shape imprint with a certain profile in temperature, and prior for the radii, which is the one that comes from internal inflation. We simulate everything.
Wait a minute. Say that again.
Prior on the side is coming from internal inflation.
Coming from what?
From the bubble distributions as bubble collisions. There is a certain distribution of sizes, the probability for the sizes.
Seriously?
Yes.
You think you know the probability of the size?
Yes.
How did you get that?
Just a simple calculation in terms of...
I mean, I looked at the paper. I see the simple zeta structure you use inside.
That's the profile, but then the probability for the radius. This is the radius. This is a disk shape. It has a certain angular amplitude. And there's a distribution for this. There's a probability distribution for this value, which is the distribution of angles that you get if you intersect a random sphere with a plane. You get the cos theta distribution. Anyway, we simulate and we get that. 50%, if you do a random simulation, 50% of the time, you get a disk which is even stronger than this one. So the map is not anomalous from this point of view.
So are you saying that, you're essentially looking for, I mean, this is an issue because we did a bunch of bubble calculations, which is actually what the main topic of this talk is supposed to be. I still don't get how one can be so definitive about bubble collision sizes, so we can address that. So since you forced me down...
That's a matter for you. I mean, just saying that if you put a distribution of sizes, you can simulate and ask how many times you get a universe like the one we see. This is doable. Okay, that's what we got. So,
8%. Yeah, I know, but you were doing essentially exactly the same thing in the sense that you had this control parameter that you got to vary, and then you were trying to optimally look for it in the maps, which meant that you were looking for sources, right? And the cold spot doesn't appear because of the specifics of the structure of what you're looking for.
Exactly, yeah. But then, okay. Then this is what Matthias and the other were saying, that then you have to change the statistics and make it more like, look like, more like the cold spot, more strange.
But that's not strange. The cold spot is not strange.
I'm not still a little confused. So, Tim, you said in 500 simulations you don't see any of this.
No, that's what I don't get. But you see, he's looking for something else which looks different.
Yeah, because maybe there is a feature in the profile, something like that. What we're looking is a disk.
I mean, what they didn't actually apparently detect, which I don't get, is they didn't detect the cold spot.
Yeah, But we detect a comma cluster, we put a bubble in the sky, we detect it.
You detected the... No, wait a minute. Oh, no, you're just talking about the ability to see it.
Yeah.
But what I do, if the characteristic scale of the bubble happened to be basically the size of the cold spot, why wouldn't it have been picked up? Is it because of the structural aspect?
We were integrating overall radii with a prior on the radii, which was, in terms of theta angle, sine of theta.
Okay. Oh, you had a specific interior structure.
No, the size.
You want the disk, which is the aperture. And the prior for the aperture?
I know, but if you happen to see a bubble, the bubble will have a characteristic size. It won't be marginalizing over all possible bubble sizes.
Yeah, I just tell that this is what we did. Probably, if you have a different distribution, you can try to...
The bubble is not very different than the cold spot.
That's what I was saying, but maybe you can... Yeah, I agree with this, not some different...
Well, no, but you aren't supposed to marginalize over everything. That would...
Why not?
Well, no, because that would mean that you would be marginalizing over scales that would be the shortest distance things all the way to the highest distance things, even if you did a measure on it. It would be, you know, kind of a strange thing to do in terms of trying to discover something. So I imagine that's not the case.
So the statistics, I'd say, is completely well-defined, this thing, completely Gauss. So what was difficult and this thing is a bit off.
Sure, okay. Once you get a good definition
of this thing, take into account the shame it might have, then the problem is well defined. Because then it's not even just in getting a good definition to the other things.
What is some of this for the simulation?
What's that? This?
It depends on the definition that you give for looking for. So you're not putting a scale a priori. No? You can say
how many blobs of n scale happen to be in the sky
with a given statistics. That's perfectly defined. You have a number count, and you're not putting any scale. Then you go in your map, you look, and you find one which is off. Okay? So they're not putting any prior on the scale. They're just saying, is this thing so coherent on a large size, sort of chunk of space, is an outlier. Okay? So you may debate on how this thing is defined in a real space. That's a difficult part.
No, but I mean, it's absolutely correct. The best way to do this is a complete up and up Monte Carlo. The as you know, Planck did a whole suite of, it's called FFP6, full focal plane Monte Carlos, and the cold spot, of course, was not put in except if it would appear by a Gaussian random realization of a power spectrum for random fluctuations, and there are no cold spots of that rarity that appear in FFP6. However, without such an exercise and without sweeps, what I needed to do is to have, just like George did, is while we're talking, have 500 of these ticking along to show you how weird it all is.
From 500, you would not say, "1C."
Anyway, from this point of view, from the point of view of this talk, there are two issues associated with anomalies. If anomalies go away, then we get to constrain these rare event phenomenologies. if the anomalies are deemed to be there, which I think we will have more information of, I would say, quite relevance with the June 2014 release, then, you know, well, one can always say, I will dismiss all anomalies. But they're there.
The cosmos will never go away.
It will not go away. It is there.
And the thing in the galaxy, I doubt very much that the majority, like four of them, will never go away.
And there is nothing to explain? Because you think that you can roll the Gaussian dice and you will get that. And you will roll the Gaussian dice and you will get a 7% low L power spectrum anomaly. So you say, no question.
That's what we did for the, if you ask every time, run a simulation. You ask how much the chi-square improves if you look for a bubble of a certain size in a random in a free amplitude, you fit it, how much you improve. The typical improvement that you get in the true data is...
But that was for a very specific thing that you were looking for. It's not.
That's completely theory-dependent.
Then you really have to work hard on the statistics you're looking for to make this more anomalous. Because if I just take a disc-shaped blob, it's not going to work. Now maybe you want to put a smiling meat or an elephant. Yeah, it has to work. Yeah, just this is what I'm saying. The disc shape doesn't work. This is the answer, I think. Then, of course, maybe it's different. This was just what I was saying.
Right. So, if you decide that you do not believe that the anomalies are statistically relevant, then we will be using the sky to just to constrain rare events that can appear by the mechanisms that I referred to. If you think they're there, then it's a pretty interesting thing to try and relate it to theories of the early universe, which is what this talk was supposed to be about, not about the anomaly. I should have known better. That this would be what it would be. Anyway, I'm going to try and move. Okay, from the beginning of the universe to the end, including our ultimate future, there were two approaches to multiverse. One was stochastic inflation, semi-eternal, which I don't see why isn't fundamental these days, because it seems like a huge number of people ascribe to the quantum tunnel story for how the universe looks on its ultra-large scale structure and seem to be ignoring that this is a natural occurrence in a medium. And so therefore their view is that bubbles are all over the place and that they will eventually collide. All right.
Let me just understand. So you're asking, why are people so into bubbles?
No, I'm asking though that the bubble people, like Lenny and others, they have a probability of a certain number of e-foldings that they say, I will assume that it looks, that basically there is a complete selection against large numbers of e-foldings, probabilistically. And that I...
Well, you have to do that so you can see the bubbles, right?
No, that's so you can see them, but that doesn't mean that that's a natural circumstance, because in the interior of a bubble, you expect all sorts of anomalies, not inhomogeneities, associated with stochastic inflation.
Normal.
Exactly, normal inflation. So this is the picture which I think is the likely scenario within the bubble, but you know, it could be the other way, and so it is worthwhile to explore it and explore it full up, and that's of course what people have done.
What I like to say is that if you actually see the signal, that's pretty cool. But I agree with your...
Yeah, but in my view, it's been completely oversold. This is the way that we will prove the landscape exists, whereas the probability is, you know, a priori is really low. But anyway, you got it's true. You got to go for it. It's just like you have to go for topology. You just, you know, the data's there. it's not going to improve. We just have to try and see everything that we can see from the data. Okay, so I think I'm going to basically skip over the modulated preheating, but probably I will, because I wanted to, what's the time and how much time do I have? It's already over?
Yes.
It's all your fault. You just can't keep quiet, can you?
You have 4.5 seconds.
4.97.
Okay, so anyway, this is a story which at least Matthias knows well, which is that buried within essentially a Gaussian random field could be intermittency, which would be interpreted in terms of anomalies. And this is an example of what might be buried below, and it's pretty interesting that it comes out naturally, that it would come in splotches like this, with some substructure to be sure. And I was going to try and explain that a little better, but this is a movie showing different realizations associated with the value of the field on scales larger than the horizon. And you can see that the trouble is that as you change that value, you can change the way everything looks, so you don't have a rigorous, unique thing to be looking for on the sky. You have to search for what is the best way, power spectrum anomalies. And you would be doing it in small regions because the high parts do not cover all of the space, because that's an example of extreme biasing. And it's very similar to the biasing, the super biasing that we get with clusters of galaxies, with one difference. It is operating on something which is essentially a flicker noise type spectrum, whereas when you deal with clusters of galaxies, this is clusters of galaxies in Lagrangian space, you have a threshold function that's focusing on rare events, but because of the nature of the density fluctuation spectrum, it's more focused on smaller scales than on the ultra-large scales when you have a thresholding function which is acting on essentially a flicker noise or a red noise type spectrum. And so that's why the appearance of this is in these splotches where you have this thresholding which is only grabbing, you know, really high parts. And so that's why it's so interestingly intermittent. And so irrespective of everything else, I think it is useful to look for intermittency in its general form in the data. And one way to do it, apart from just doing the source thing like was done for the cold spot, is in fact to do, you know, focused power spectra in all sorts of spots on the sky, which of course has been done at some level, but not at the level that it should be. So I think that's a neat thing to do. Anyway, so we have a theory that can generate all of that. And one of the problems we have, but we don't know how serious a problem, is that there is a power spectrum asymmetry which automatically appears. It seems to diminish as you go to very high L, and it is buried within the main inflaton CL power spectrum. So this rather dramatic difference between a power asymmetry, which would, you know, it's this side compared to this side, would be buried below, you know, the usual power symmetric inflaton-induced curvature. But this is there, and one of the big questions out of Planck, and Matthias was doing Planck bashing in the S-Lab meeting when we were first discussing this, saying this cannot be that there's such an anomaly here. The current estimate is that it's certainly sub-percent, probably less than 0.2%. And that it's going to be very, very difficult, maybe impossible, to try and unravel it relative to the dipole power asymmetry that's induced by our motion. But that is not the case at the larger scales, up to, let's say, 400, where in WMAP and in Planck, there is a power anomaly, and the power anomaly is about 7%.
It's picking the plane that maximizes it.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's a legitimate thing you're searching for. But, you know, as I said, in some respects, a better way to do it is to try and assemble the statistics in splotches and then try and look at the distribution so that you aren't just doing the hemispherical asymmetry. It's a very small effect, and actually I don't know in detail why it should be so difficult, but it's because, you know, noise properties, once you go to very high L, so you have this variable amplitude, the dipole effect. Let's see. The asymmetry shifts on the sky as you go to high L at lesser significance and moves up towards the dipole from the region, and this isn't a correct description, but unfortunately, this says, here we go. So, you know, the power asymmetry is pointing in this direction, right? But then as you go to higher L with the dipole, it tends to migrate up a bit. Hopefully not. No, I don't know. I mean, maybe it does. The thing about the ADC systematics is that we are still coming to grips with them. So it could play a role, but we don't fully know.
I didn't understand. Is it understood why the small-scale power asymmetry would couple with the modulation?
Well, no. There would be two points. One is that it's like a modulation of all of the delta T over T. Okay, that is also not what I want to get to with the talk. I just want to say that there is interesting phenomenology, and I'm going to, I'm just going to have to skip over everything I wanted to talk about because of this silly discussion. Because, you know, there was another theme of the meeting, which is flattening potentials. You probably were here for Kalosh-Linde, but flattening potentials, ways to do this. It's nice that they are, like many people, resurrecting what we did back in 89 in terms of how to flatten potentials, as have we. We've done simulations with the flattened potentials. We get the same results without the flattened potentials associated with this intermittency. I'm going to skip over that. So I'm going to say a few words, and I'm sure I won't get much further than this thing, but I hope so. I hope to show you some simulations of bubbles. So the bubbly gospel, and so you should be defending the bubbly vision. Because I have questions about the bubbly vision. All of my issues are in red. So we live in a bubble, one among many, the nature of the universe. That's the picture, and that may well be true, but stochastic semi-eternal inflation. All right, I made that point. Everybody assumes that the Coleman de Lucia instant time with a certain maximal symmetry is exactly the right thing to do. And that is to say, it's gospel. That is not always the case. Various potentials can give you thick walls. We'll see that in a moment, as well as thin walls. And so, it's not at all clear to me that what people assume, which you can do because it's effectively analytic, is in fact always the right thing to do. Depending upon the nature of the landscape, going from one minimum to another, you can even have fluctuations about the instanton. The instanton is the Euclidean classical path in field space. And if it's a thick wall bubble, you expect that you will actually get fluctuations about it. Then there are all sorts of other issues. It's undoubtedly true that you have multiple fields present. So how exactly are the bubbles manifesting themselves in that? Picture is that it's choosing the minimum path in a complex landscape in order to do its tunnel, which you can imagine that there are multiple directions for tunneling and all sorts of things that are never ever discussed. And in fact, the usual discussion of the bubbly universe is sort of like one scalar field degree of freedom as opposed to it being really complex, with complexity growing as you go up the landscape potential to the extent that there is one, because more degrees of freedom start to appear. So calculating the tunneling is probably something that needs a lot of work. It begins with negative curvature, and the negative curvature is initially of order the radius of the bubble that is produced. And so this is the claim of the people doing it. I mentioned this. They assume that the probability of the number of E-folds, assume it to be sure, goes like 1 over NP, where P is a large number. And so if that were true, then N would be just enough to get inflation. It would be an anthropic consideration, and that anthropic consideration would say, you should see negative curvature. Of course, we have not seen negative curvature, not at any level, and so then the issue is, okay, so there's been probably some inflation within our highly curved bubbles so that it's diminished the amount of curvature. And if that is true, then why wouldn't there be a lot of such inflation? And if there is, then the bubbly aspect is not as relevant. So when you look on the sky, and this is where you got to come to the defense of what you do, you look for a rotation group 2-1 symmetric collision. So you take the basic symmetry of these bubbles, translate it into real space, and then you let them hit each other, and that gives you sort of this symmetry around this axis. And so Kleban calls them cosmic wakes for reasons I don't quite know, and that's what you search for. The scale to be determined, that is to say, Leonardo tells us he knows the probability distribution for this scale. I would say, wow, because I don't really see how you can get that without it. But I would say that the most likely scenario is that, and I think everybody agrees, actually having a bubble visible within our horizon is a highly improbable thing. And if it is probable for some reason that we haven't figured out, it would have to be, in order to explain the data we see, highly, highly subdominant. And so you might expect that if you actually do have this collision of bubbles, there would be a tremendous asymmetry, and so it would be an absolutely booming signal rather than a tiny signal, and we cannot tolerate anything but a tiny signal. That is not to say that I have anything against looking for it on the sky. We have the data now, we got to look for everything, right? So I think it is significant to do, and that we should try and inform our search patterns by as much as we know. Okay, but...
Do we have a huge number?
What's that?
Everything we see just be a huge number of bubble collisions.
Well, of course, that some was... Yeah, that was the vision at some level of the original Guthrian inflation, except that it didn't work, because the bubbles actually never really did all of the collisions that was wanted. But the idea was that the end of inflation would be due to all sorts of bubble collisions, and that that would be the heating phenomenon.
And I think it's very difficult, the bubble collision of any scale, to get that scale in
line. Okay, however, the point of this talk is that in fact, inevitably, within a bubble, there are quantum fluctuations, just like there are that are the curvature fluctuations that create all of the structure in the universe. You can't avoid it. And so it turns out that when bubbles collide, there are instabilities that occur. Those instabilities can make the interior of a bubble colliding complex rather than simple. The assumptions that have been usually done is that it's incredibly simple. We don't have the answer of whether this is relevant. We just know that instability is a fundamental nature of this. One of the things that happens is when these two collide, a lot of scalar field radiation goes off. That's not surprising. But what you can also get, fairly generically, are what are called oscillons, which are long-lived field configurations. And so, you know, we get them all the time in our simulations. The CMB, when you look at it with fuzzy eyes, which is what you do and what you did, that smooths over this complexity. And the question is the complexity on such a short distance scale that that basically it looks like it's smooth. But whatever is true, its evolution is different than whatever you think it is if you only deal with these 1D type solutions, which is what people have done and what has motivated these searches. And you know, it's you aren't the only searchers, there are others. Okay, the other comment actually this Clevin was making is that bubble collisions can make large scale modulations. I didn't quite understand what he said about this. Did you? I mean, it's obviously true that you can get large-scale things happening, and you can have control parameters with the fields, perhaps, but I'm not quite sure what he meant. I mean, modulations in the sense of our modulations. Anyway, that's another. So from the work that we were doing, we treat bubble creation and propagation as an interesting nonlinear field theory problems in their own right, and they may have a cosmological setting. We haven't really felt that we have a really good setting. What we have been doing recently is embedding bubble collisions within an overall inflating scenario. And if I can, I will show a movie before finishing to show you the sorts of things that we're getting. Okay, so here is an example of how that would work. These potentials are the classic breaking potentials for Higgs, for example. Phi squared and V is a vacuum expectation value. And so you've got two minima, this normalized to plus or minus one in this. And then you add an asymmetry parameter that allows this to be higher than this so that you can this is the symmetric tunnel, and then up here we have a whole sequence of different tunnels. The one which I think I have a picture, a movie of, is delta 1/30, which is this one here. And so the tunnel goes from here to here, and what happens to the field dynamics? Because this is a fully 3D calculation, you see remarkable phenomenon occurring. But before I get to that, and then this direction is the inflaton direction. So the idea is that you can do a tunnel while there is a flow down with an inflation. This could be a little basin, and then there's this overall sort of large-scale flow in the inflation, or it could just be sort of, you know, tracking alongside with the possibility of doing a tunnel here. What is that tunneling rate? Well, you can calculate the tunneling rate, and then you'd have to adjust things to make sure it's not infinitesimal. But you can do that. But it's just sort of neat what happens. Then there's another case that those are called thin wall cases, and there's an approximate analytic solution to the way they look. It turns out that's not good enough. Everything has to be done numerically here. This is a thick wall case. This has sort of got some similarity to what people used to do with what was called a new inflation, where there was a little bit of a tunnel right at the beginning and then some kind of motion. And what we get here we haven't been exhaustive, is actually a pretty remarkable phenomena where the what's happening down here depends upon the instanton solution that enters. And so we've taken this sort of extreme example. Anyway, I won't show that. I'm just going to show you something that looks kind of neat. Anyway. Even in this simple system, there are a large number of control parameters that you can fool around with. And this is the sort of thing that, as far as we know, hasn't really been done by anybody. You know, a systematic study of these bubbly events in 3D. I was going to go through the history of oscillons, but I think it's more fun to collide things together. So this collision of two bubbles has quantum fluctuations, and this one does. And you will see that there is a dramatic difference of what happens in the interior of this collision. So there's at the beginning there's a very simple phenomenology, and then the quantum fluctuations grow. It's an unstable situation, and it produces all of this remarkable interior structure. And so then the question is there any utility for that interior structure? The characteristic scale of that interior structure, remember the potential, there's a characteristic mass which is finding the curvature of the potential, and the characteristic scale of these objects is some number times that M inverse scale. And so our first reaction is, well, the problem is that those M's, even when you blow them up, take them to the current time observable scales, is that they probably won't be big enough for them to be, you know, have a little blob memory on the sky. Maybe they will. It's something that one should continue to explore. But, you know, this is a pretty interesting interior structure that relative to this rather nice interior structure, and this is in fact the way the interior should look when bubbles collide. This is the kind of thing. There's been a flow of scalar radiation out, but then there is this residual complex field theory that will exist inside. And those potentials that I showed you are in no way tuned in any special way. I mean, you know, if you were going to write down something arbitrarily, you'd do a phi squared minus v squared squared. That's just what you do. And then to do a little breaking on that, of course you do it because you want to be in sort of a classic tunneling situation. This one, do I really want to?
Any B-mode?
Rest assured, we have thought about the gravitational response, and there is a little bit. But the problem is, the system is really trying to do scalar radiation and not gravitational radiation. And the blobs that you create are interesting, but they aren't gravitational entities. So they don't form primordial black holes or anything like that. They're sort of long-lived field oscillations that exist. And there will be some kind of gravity wave response to them. It would probably be very short distance. Probably we wouldn't get it with the experiments that we're interested in. But
the perturbation, the scalar field description of the bubble is it linear or when you approach the walls of the bubble, is linear?
What's linear?
The variation of the field
in
passing through the wall of the bubble.
Well, it's all
non-linear. It's non-linear. So you might expect transfer of power from scalar degrees of freedom to vector in tensors.
Yeah, that's the gravitational response. The way you do the gravitational response is the easiest way to do it is you just do the simulation and then you do a linear response because the back action isn't that relevant. I mean, there's a in dealing with bubbles, actually, it's a really difficult problem. When I have two bubbles that are colliding, I really should be taking into account in absolute detail the how exactly the inhomogeneous scale factor goes from one to the other. And we deal with this in an approximate way, which we think is quite accurate. But in an ideal world, this would be a general relativistic simulation of colliding bubbles. That's exactly what you would like to do. Anyway, I didn't talk much about this complexity. What we get for this sort of class of models is scalar radiation at the level of about 90% and leaving about 10% oscillon energy left. When Amin talked about this earlier in the meeting, he was claiming 80%, and we just don't see that, and we don't quite understand why. They were looking at oscillons in preheating. So it's a very different kind of potential they were dealing with than the kind that we're dealing with. So maybe that's the reason, I don't know. But anyway, that was a little puzzle for us. You don't want to see this. This is showing something that I won't even talk about. So this is the same thing with the inflation occurring that we're sort of putting in by hand. And it really looks quite similar. It's not dramatically different. So the other thing had no overall inflation, and this one has inflation in it, and the bubble collision. Of course, it's still a remarkable phenomenon. Of course, you know, what you have to do is you've got the overall Hubble parameter associated with the inflation, and then you have the potential differences, et cetera. And, you know, how do you decide exactly what those values should be in order to make an interesting phenomenology? You know, if you make the values of the potential difference really high, then it can swamp what happens in the inflation. But if you make the inflation with this really high, you know, potential, then this is sort of not very relevant relative to it. So there's some kind of optimal thing to do. I don't know. Anyway, complexity is the story of the game. Does the observable universe use double Hubble bubblelessness? C and B intermittency. So we'll see. And I'm going to leave on a last thing, which is something that I quite like, which are axionic type potentials. So this is a pseudo-Nambu Goldstone boson. So you would think of this as the other direction, but it's a shift symmetry. And so what happens when you have this type of collision is that you have this potential and it's going over it again and again and again. And what that does, it leads to instability because as you go around and around and around the angular variable, it turns out that the amplitudes keep growing. So I'm going to show that again. this was one direction of collision, but this is showing the field. Wrong one. Yeah, showing the field as it's going through its sort of kink anti-kink oscillations. And then what you're going to see, so this direction is the angle. So 2 pi's are the relevant number in the scale here, and this is going to like 40. And then as it's propagating around in angle, you'll see what happens when it hits down here, that these fluctuations start to go crazy and there are instabilities. And then in a different slice, that's the way they look. And so it's quite a remarkable phenomena for what looks like a simple system. And it probably, but we haven't quite figured out, it probably has some applications to something that Kleben talked about here at the meeting in April. They call it, I think it's unwinding inflation. It involves D-brain, so it's not exactly like what we're doing, but it's the basic idea of having, in effect, a shift symmetry that's playing a role. And so, my conclusions, because I didn't get to show you what I really wanted to show you, is that it's a tremendous high nonlinearity game, and it is inevitable in the early universe. By one mechanism or another, we're used to dealing with linear perturbation theory and inflation, but that's not the whole story. And the nonlinearity can lead possibly to observable effects. It happens. You can't avoid it. This, we think you can't avoid. It's just a question of rarity for our Hubble patch. End of inflation had to end, had to do this nonlinear cascade, and may have this modulated structure to it. So does it lead to observable rare event anomalies, or just weak, and emphasis here on weak, constraints on multi-field potentials, on the greater than the horizon fields, on nucleation rates for the bubbles, etc.? That's quite possible, because these things just might not be in our horizon. But I hope that what you come away with here is that you can get amusing patterns, and you probably have to work at it to make sure that the patterns are subdominant. Because if they're dominant, then they're already ruled out, because they can be quite outrageous. So subdominant, you have to work at a bit. But anyway, that's where I'll end.
No, the anomaly. The fact that there are other light fields, which you need to do.
You're saying that they aren't there? No light fields?
I'm saying I don't know. You are the ones that are saying they have to be there. The ones that are making outrageous, claims that of certainty is not enough. I'm just saying I don't know, and there's no evidence for them. Maybe it's an anomaly, but they don't have to be there.
It is true. They don't have to be there.
It's easy not to. I mean, I don't know.
The graviton has to be there.
Oh, yeah, you got it. But you cannot do it.
No, you can't do this with the graviton.
So you need another light scatter field?
However, it isn't easy to have a fairly rapid end of inflation with just one field.
No, but from the end of inflation, we see nothing. So that if you have one field before and you have an attractor, you don't see anything. Because you see something because there was somebody lying on us. It's just something about the end of the patient. We didn't have a single field thing in an attractor. We would not do something different. You have some.
It's true that if I arrange for an extremely heavy field that essentially totally forces a pinning of all isocurvature degrees of freedom, and then they only open up at the very end.
You know, all the masses get looked correct. I mean, the fact that they're heavy, it might even be more reasonable than getting them light. It's difficult to get scalars light. So, I mean, he said, I'm happy to have all of the scalar lights. I'm just saying I wouldn't be as certain as your other version of the scalar.
I would not be so bold as to say I know exactly what's happening in the early universe. It is interesting, and I will ask you then, where are the standard model degrees of freedom?
They're just fine. I mean, they're there.
Are they heavy? Why can't I have side by side? And then why can't it be collective? Why does it have to be? Why does it have to be a fundamental scalar? After all, the inflaton is a collective field.
I totally agree. It's not a fundamental scalar. bigger scale, and even I suppose that even for this complex scale, the issue of the mass of the scale is very heavy, it's the same. It doesn't matter. It's, I don't think that what have we so sure that. In fact, isn't there some...
But one way or another, you...
So what is the ETA problem? That even the, for the inflaton, I'm not so sure how can I make it light. The one that I... Okay?
Well, that's true.
So if this is just a sociological argument, which is not a very good one.
Not a very good one at all.
If even for the inflaton, we have to, how is it that we get something like that happen? This must probably mean that having many more is not inevitable. That's if not, then I don't. This is a silly argument. Getting a light scalar is not a guarantee.
It is not guaranteed.
So then having more of them, okay.
But that's not what this says. This says highly nonlinear field evolution happened.
Yeah, but if you only have the inflaton, you get nothing.
No. That, you're talking about modulation.
Yeah, all of
this statement models. Is a true statement. End of inflation will require, it will definitely require highly nonlinear field evolution because it has to cascade. Then the question is, are there observables from it?
But for this, you need the light gas
before. I agree with that. But and so, therefore, the question.
Potentially detectable gravitational wave signal, PMB, but...
From preheating. That's correct. They had to, my good friend Lev Kaufman was one of the champions of that. You had to push things so that in some future Big Bang observatory you might be able to see something, and it's much smaller scale.
But also the frequency would show up.
Oh, no, that's true, yeah. I know, but the characteristic scale would be the characteristic scale of the horizon at preheating, which is commoving about a centimeter. So it would be, so the blobs that you create are slightly below that commoving scale. And so those are the things that you're responding to, but to get the gravitational field response. And so blobbiness is interesting, and so these oscillons are interesting, and just the nonlinear field dynamics is interesting, but it isn't easy to get the response large enough so that we'll be able to see it. It would be fabulous were it true, and it would, open up another way of going after gravitational waves from inflation, which would not be just through the microwave background, which is a good lead into tomorrow's session. Oh, I should have known better. It was supposed to be a really quick introduction,
You know you put a lot of